This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Area News. Important stories that impact your life do not always happen in the metro area. Keep up with the news happening all around you and in your neighborhood, no matter where you live. For the next 60 minutes, it's Area News, right here on your audio reading service.
Welcome, this is Area News, and I'm your reader, Pat Weiss, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from KPC News articles and the Monroeville News, the Wayndale News, and the Decatur Daily Democrat. And now I'll begin with some articles from 2025 KPC News. Domestic Violence Awareness Event Planned, an article by Jeff Jones, October 1, 2025. Auburn. Domestic violence takes on many forms. It doesn't discriminate between male and female. It does not always involve physical violence. Victims often don't want to talk about it. And it happens right here in DeKalb County. While it's not an everyday occurrence in the police blotter that appears in this newspaper, you will see individuals who have been charged with domestic battery, rape, strangulation, intimidation, and invasion of privacy. To raise awareness of the situation, the DeKalb County Domestic Violence Task Force will stage a Silent Voices event from 5 to 8 p.m. Friday in the James Cultural Plaza. Domestic Violence Today. According to statistics provided by Rebecca Gruwell, a victim advocate with the DeKalb County Prosecutor's Office, 61 cases of domestic battery have been filed in the county from January 1, 2025 to September 1st. In that time frame, there have been 24 cases of invasion of privacy, 4 cases of rape, 4 cases of strangulation, 2 reports of domestic battery by means of a deadly weapon, 2 cases of domestic battery resulting in moderate bodily injury, and 2 cases of stalking. In addition, the prosecutor's office has had reports of domestic battery resulting in bodily injury to a pregnant woman and serious bodily injury. Domestic violence in recent years. In 2023, there were 57 domestic battery cases reported, with 3 resulting in moderate bodily injury and 3 by means of a deadly weapon. In 2024, there were 78 domestic battery cases reported. 5 resulted in moderate bodily injury and 1 was by means of a deadly weapon. There were 25 reports of invasion of privacy in 2023, which jumped to 33 reported cases last year. There were 4 reports of strangulation in 2023, which more than doubled to 9 last year. There was 1 murder in DeKalb County last year. It's important to note that those are the cases reported to police, who then file a case report with the prosecutor's office seeking charges. No one knows how many incidents of domestic violence go unreported. Getting involved. That's why Johnny Barth got involved. She led an effort to reactivate the task force in January 2024. It had existed for some time prior to the pandemic, but became inactive. Barth knows about domestic violence from personal experience. She is a domestic violence survivor. Sometimes that's a hard thing for you to point out yourself when you're the one who's in the situation, she said. After an initial task force meeting in November 2023 failed to gain any traction, Barth decided to take charge and move forward the following January. I went ahead and just sent out emails to the organizations in the area, police departments, local government agencies, treatment centers in the area, she said. You're looking at the prosecutor's office and some attorneys in the area, and then we have Bowen Health, Northeastern Center, YWCA. I had a full room at the meeting. That in itself was growth, because when I used to attend the task force meetings, there were maybe 3 or 4 people there, including myself, Barth said. I want to put an emphasis on educating people in the community about domestic violence, so we can hold free lunch and learn sessions that people can come and get a free lunch, learn about what domestic violence is, and that they can get help. Raising awareness. Friday's event will feature life-sized cutout figures spread out about the plaza with domestic violence statistics. Each figure represents an individual who lost their life to domestic violence. While many of the figures represent adults, there are silhouettes of children as well. The cutouts painted in red indicate people who lost their lives to domestic violence in DeKalb County, while the rest are painted purple and will come with domestic violence statistics. The event will bring together groups such as Bowen Health, Fortify Life, and Iris Family Support Center, formerly known as SCAN, to name a few. Family members who have lost relatives to domestic violence have been invited to attend. Some of them may share their stories with attendees. Our goal is to raise awareness and provide resources so that we can not only acknowledge that there is a domestic violence problem in DeKalb County, but also bring awareness and education so that people can understand whether or not they're in a domestic violence situation, Barth said. Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Following Friday's event, the silhouettes will be placed throughout the county for the rest of October, as October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. The hope is that people will stop and pay attention to them, and it will raise awareness, Barth said. Domestic violence isn't just against females. According to 2024 statistics from the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence and the Indiana Domestic Violence Fatality Review Team, 44 females lost their lives to domestic violence, but so did 38 males. A fetus also died when its mother was killed. 6 of the fatalities were by blunt force, while 5 others were by asphyxia and 3 were by stabbing. There were 2 deaths each by strangulation, blunt force involving an automobile, and undetermined. 1 death each was reported by smoke inhalation and lack of maternal support. 38 of the fatalities represented a current or former intimate partner to the perpetrator, while 30 were related to the perpetrator. 6 of those were children. Of those fatalities, 61 involved a firearm, including general, suicide, officer involved, shot by survivor or bystander. More than 11 fatalities were reported in Allen and Marion counties. Locally, between 1 to 5 fatalities because of domestic violence occurred in DeKalb and Noble counties during that period. While no deaths resulting from domestic violence were reported in either LaGrange or Steuben counties in 2024, means that there were none reported. This does not mean that 0 occurred, the report said. All-day conference. An all-day conference devoted to domestic violence awareness will take place from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Tuesday, October 28th, at the First United Methodist Church, 1203 East 7th Street, Auburn. Lunch will be provided. There is a $50 cost and scholarships are available. People may register at DeKalb County Domestic Violence Task Force.com or on Facebook at DeKalb County Domestic Violence Task Force. The task force meets at noon, the third Tuesday of each month at the Community Foundation DeKalb County, 700 South Main Street. Patriotic display unveiled at courthouse. A staff report from Auburn. As the nation prepares to celebrate America's 250th birthday, the DeKalb County Courthouse is marking the occasion with an updated display honoring the country's history. The new exhibit, spearheaded by the DeKalb County Commissioners in partnership with the Courthouse Display Case Committee and the DeKalb County John Holton Chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution, or DAR, aims to bring history to life for courthouse visitors. The DAR, well known for its commitment to education, historic preservation, and honoring veterans and patriots, contributed a rich collection of artifacts for the display. Among the items on view are reproduction of the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights, First 10 Amendments, patriotic bunting flags, commemorative DAR plates, a chapter scrapbook, state and national DAR certificates, vintage ribbons, and a handmade chapter flag. Two blue stars preserved from the massive Glenbrook Dodge 80-pound flag are also featured, alongside a pewter tankard, a pewter tea set, an 18th-century grease lamp, bone dice from the era of the 1760s Stamp Act, a candle mold, and a Revolutionary War bayonet. The case also includes a variety of other local DAR memorabilia, offering a glimpse into national and DeKalb County history. The effort to bring the display to life was a true community collaboration. The DeKalb County Commissioners, Bill Hartman, Jim Miller, and Kellen Dooley, supported the initiative. Hartman also served on the Display Case Committee alongside DeKalb County historian Mary Deal and Auburn police officer Cody Berniston. Sue Anderson represented the DAR and worked closely with the committee to organize and curate the display. Together, these groups have created a space that commemorates America's founding and highlights local organizations like the DAR's critical role in preserving history. As America 250 approaches, the new courthouse display invites all DeKalb County residents to reflect on the nation's past and celebrate the people and stories that shaped it. Local police officers make three arrests in Auburn. Police made these arrests Monday, according to DeKalb County jail records. Wakanya Rogers, 32, of the 4400 block of Southwest Anthony Wayne Drive, Fort Wayne, was arrested at 10:10 a.m. September 29th by the DeKalb County Sheriff's Office on a warrant alleging driving while suspended, a Class A misdemeanor. Rogers was being held on $250 cash-only bond, according to jail records. Richard Norris, 44, of the 200 block of East Lake Road, Geneva, was arrested at 11:10 a.m. September 29th by the DeKalb County Sheriff's Office on a warrant alleging non-support of a dependent, a level 6 felony. Norris was being held on a $1,000 cash-only bond, according to jail records. Chantel Capps, 34, of the 9800 block of Lakeshore Drive, Leo, was arrested at 3:35 p.m. September 29th by Indiana State Police on a charge of operating a vehicle while intoxicated, with prior a level 6 felony. Capps was being held on a $7,500 cash or 10% clerk bond, according to jail records. Community Foundation, DeKalb County, launches Giving Tuesday 2025 campaign, a staff report from Auburn. The Community Foundation, DeKalb County, will kick off Giving Tuesday DeKalb 2025, a community-wide fundraising campaign. The event will run from October 6th through November 22nd. This annual initiative invites community members to come together to support local nonprofits that strengthen DeKalb County. Nonprofit organizations with endowment funds at the foundation are eligible to participate, with opportunities to earn additional unrestricted grants. The top five fundraising organizations will be awarded $5,000 for first place, $3,000 for second place, $2,000 for third place, $1,000 for fourth place, $1,000 for fifth place, and $3,000 for the largest percentage increase in fundraising compared to the previous year. Winners will be announced on Giving Tuesday, December 22nd, a global day dedicated to generosity and community impact. Community members can participate by donating in the following ways: by mail at Community Foundation, DeKalb County, Post Office Box 111, Auburn, Indiana, 46706. In person, 700 South Main Street, Auburn, Monday to Friday, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Online, cfdkalb.org. Directly to organizations, give to your favorite participating nonprofit and designate the gift to their endowment fund. Giving Tuesday DeKalb is an opportunity for all of us to invest in the future of DeKalb County, said Foundation Executive Director Tanya Young. Every gift, large or small, helps strengthen local nonprofits and the vital work they do. Library hosting program on Raleigh Zider, a staff report from Auburn. Eckerd Public Library will welcome Chad Gramling on Wednesday, October 15th at 6 p.m. for a presentation on local baseball player, Raleigh Hubert Zider. Raleigh Zider, a quirky stitch in baseball's tapestry, will take place in the assembly room of the main library. Baseball fans of all ages are invited to learn about the baseball journeyman's compelling and oft-overlooked life and career. Zider's career spanned three major leagues, three Chicago teams, and spawned countless colorful anecdotes. Hoosier-born and Auburn-raised, Zider's legacy is a blend of versatility, speed, and small-town charm. Whether you're a baseball buff or just love a good underdog tale, Raleigh Zider's journey from sawmill towns to the big leagues is one worth celebrating. Chad Gramling is a writer, historian, and chronicler of Northeast Indiana's rich baseball heritage. His deep-rooted passion for the game's history has shaped much of his work, including Baseball in Fort Wayne, a definitive exploration of the region's storied diamond past. He also authored Legendary Locals of Auburn and other books, all blending cultural insight with compelling narrative. Gramling balances his creative pursuits with his role as AVP of Business Intelligence at Three Rivers FCU, while remaining active in his church and serving on the board of the Auburn Arts Commission. He is currently working on Aveline Turning, a historical fiction novel set in 1908 Fort Wayne and surrounding Northeast Indiana locales, with intentions to publish in 2026. Gramling lives in Auburn with his wife Jennifer and their children. DeKalb County Toys for Tots, conducting registration. A staff report from Auburn. DeKalb County Toys for Tots has announced dates for in-person registration. Registration will take place October 4th and October 18th and November 8th from 9 a.m. to noon at Eckerd Public Library, 603 South Jackson Street. Parents should bring a current driver's license or state ID, original birth certificates for each child, or guardianship paperwork, and a current utility bill showing county residence. Families can also apply online at auburn-in.toysfortots.org. Email or call with questions to Jennifer Alvarez at 908-2701. Do not contact the library with questions. Applications will be accepted until November 15th. Toys for Tots is also looking for businesses that are willing to be toy drop-off locations. That involves putting one of the organization's boxes in their place of business where the community can drop off new toys. Interested parties can contact Alvarez via email or phone. Corona Barn Vehicles Destroyed in Fire. An article by Jeff Jones, Corona. A pole barn was destroyed in a Wednesday afternoon fire southeast of Corona. The fire was reported at 2:48 p.m. in the 1100 block of County Road 34, just east of the S-curve on State Road 327. Nine firefighters responded to the scene, Corona Assistant Fire Chief Eric Kennedy said. The pole barn, measuring approximately 40 feet by 60 feet, was fully involved in flames when firefighters arrived. Kennedy said the pole barn, which contained three vehicles, equipment, and tools, was a total loss. A house just east of the barn sustained some melted siding, but Kennedy said the fire did not spread into the house. It is believed that a spark from someone working on an automobile in the barn ignited. It is believed that a spark from someone working on an automobile in the barn ignited the blaze. Kennedy said that the investigation is ongoing. There were no injuries. Approximately 35 firefighters from Corunna, Garrett, Ashley Hudson, Auburn, Waterloo, Kendallville, Avila, Lyoto, and Albion assisted at the scene. Firefighters remained at the scene for several hours. Honor Flight Northeast Indiana celebrates Flight 53, a staff report from Fort Wayne. Honor Flight Northeast Indiana will celebrate its 53rd flight to Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, October 8th. It is my wish to honor the veterans who have bravely supported and fought for our county and the freedoms we enjoy, said Fort Wayne resident Tony Murray, a retired Fort Wayne Community Schools teacher. Murray is sponsoring the flight. The October 8th honor flight currently consists of a total of 85 veterans, 4 Cold War veterans, and 81 Vietnam veterans. The October flight will have 5 Purple Heart recipients and 5 Bronze Star recipients aboard. To date, 3,982 veterans have traveled on honor flights from Fort Wayne to view the memorials that were built in their honor. We extend our heartfelt appreciation to Toni Murray for her generosity over the past several years. This is her second full flight sponsorship. We are truly grateful for her continuous support of our veterans and Honor Flight Northeast Indiana, said HFNI President Kathy Berkshire. We encourage everyone to attend the Welcome Home Celebration to honor these heroes when they return home from Washington, D.C. Those attending should plan to arrive at the Fort Wayne International Airport around 8 to 8:30 p.m. and park in long-term parking or the area designated for additional parking. The airport will shuttle service for those parking outside the long-term parking area. Due to construction at the airport, most of the Welcome Home celebration will be held outside. Honor Flight Northeast Indiana, Incorporated is a volunteer, nonprofit, 501c3 organization. Donations are tax-deductible to the full extent allowed by law. 39th Apple Festival gets underway on weekend. An article by Cheryl Prentice, Kendallville. The 39th Annual Apple Festival of Kendallville at the Noble County Fairgrounds and a new event, the first ever Family Harvest Festival in downtown Kendallville, will entertain thousands of visitors this weekend with fall fun, food, and pioneer skills. Nearly 40 vendors, 30 antique vendors, many crafters, open-air demonstrators, and primitives will offer plenty to do for visitors of all ages. The Deco Children's Pioneer Craft Village will feature Indiana Wilds Petting Zoo, pony rides, games, and crafts. Admission to the Apple Festival is free to attend. Visitors may walk into the festival at Gates Fair Street and at the corner of Fair and Wayne Streets. The cost is $5 per car to park on the fairgrounds with the entrance at 902 Dowling Street. Only cash is accepted at the gate. There is no ATM located close to this gate. Free off-site parking is available at 3 locations: East Noble Middle School on Drake Road, Rural King on Fairview Boulevard, and at the Family Harvest Festival, where parking is behind the Main Street businesses. Free shuttle buses, which are accessibility equipped, will take visitors to and from the Apple Festival. This is the best option for anyone with mobility issues. Handicap parking is available on the fairgrounds, but it is not ideal for those with mobility issues. The parking area is not paved or flat. Wheelchairs and motorized scooters are permitted at the festival, and visitors are welcome to bring their own. No wheelchairs or motorized scooters are available to rent at the festival. Only licensed service animals specifically trained to aid a person with a disability are welcome at the festival. Otherwise, no dogs are allowed on the festival grounds. All vendors on the festival grounds are set up to accept cash. Some of the craft, antique, and demonstration vendors are also able to accept a credit card. 3 ATMs are available on the festival grounds. The primitive contests take place on the north end of the primitive area, across from the grandstand. Contestants must be in pioneer costume to compete in the ladies' skillet throw on Saturday at 1:30 p.m. and Sunday at 11 a.m., or the tomahawk throw on Saturday at 2 p.m. and Sunday at 11:30 a.m. The Raise a Ruckus cast of East Noble High School students will perform its rollicking show both days at 11 a.m., 12:30 p.m., and 3:30 p.m. and 2 p.m., alongside Miss Indiana Kinley Shoemaker and Miss Indiana Outstanding Teen Addison Chatton. The Apple Festival schedule is on Saturday, October 4th, starting at 9 a.m. and going until 4 p.m. On Sunday, October 5th, it's from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Family Harvest Festival. Historic downtown Kendallville will host the first annual Family Harvest Festival on Main Street and in Founders Park at Main and Rush Streets from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Saturday and 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday. This festival is about celebrating the community, said HDK President Kathy Lawson. It's a chance for families to come together, enjoy the heart of our city, and support the small businesses that are the backbone of Kendallville's economy. Admission is free for food, games, free children's activities, a variety of craft vendors, and entertainment each day. Pets are welcome on a leash. No skateboards or scooters are permitted. Free public parking is available behind the Main Street businesses for the Free Harvest Festival. The park is a stop on the Apple Festival's free shuttle bus route from Rural King and East Noble Middle School parking lots. For more information, visit these links. Apple Festival at KendallvilleAppleFestival.com or the Family Harvest Festival. Visit Facebook.com/profile. Rome City Legion extends helping hand for women's benefit. An article by Cheryl Prentice, Rome City. Catherine Martin of Wolcottville has made friends at American Legion Post 381 in Rome City since moving here in September from Kentucky to be closer to her family. Her sister, Terry Gallup, and her husband, Jeff, are members at the post. Martin said Tuesday that her father also served in the military. Martin was born with spina bifida and has been in a wheelchair since 2005. Spina bifida is a condition where the spinal column does not close properly before birth. She has lived all her life with medical problems and procedures, and at 51 has endured more than 70 surgeries. She knows that more surgeries will be in her future. Martin lives independently and drives an adaptive van that has both hand and leg controls. Her legs are losing strength, so her van must be refitted with all hand controls. On Saturday, Martin's Legion friends are throwing a day-long benefit to raise money to install hand controls in her adaptive van. The fundraising goal is $5,000 for the controls, installation, and training to use it. The public is invited to attend the benefit. The post opens at 11 a.m. and will have a large bake sale, a silent auction of more than 70 items to date, numerous drawings, food, and a signature drink at the bar. The backyard will be open for cornhole and other games of all ages. Smoked pulled pork, baked beans, and chips will be served for a donation at lunchtime. Later in the afternoon, Sue's Twin Six Broasted Chicken with broasted potatoes and a side will be served. Tankhead plays 1980s rock from 8 p.m. to closing. Martin said spinal bifida affects everyone differently depending on where the spine doesn't seal. A hole higher on the spine will affect upper body movement and punctuation. The spine is supposed to close, but a section doesn't seal, Martin said. Mine is from the tailbone down, so it affects everything below the waist. It makes a fatty growth, but the nerve endings are still exposed. Martin was born in Ohio and moved to Indiana when she was 12, then to South Bend and on to New York. She moved to Kentucky a year ago to be closer to her fiancé, but they've agreed that she needs to be closer to her family for care. She was not diagnosed with spina bifida at birth, even though she had a lump on her back. She had her first surgery at 2 days old to create a rectal opening because none had developed. By age two, her feet were turning inward, so doctors concentrating on straightening her feet. Martin finally got treatment at age 12 at Shriners Hospital in Chicago, where she finally got the diagnosis of spinal bifida. Shriners Hospital kept treating Martin until age 21, long past the kid's age. Other problems appeared early in her life, too. Her bladder didn't grow, so doctors reconstructed a new bladder at Riley Children's Hospital. That worked for a while, but ultimately she developed bladder cancer, uterine cancer, and a melanoma on her neck. A spinal surgery in 2005 to patch the hole in her spine was not successful, and Martin ended up in a wheelchair. The patch still leaks spinal fluid. Martin attended college and became a medical assistant until she was unable to work at that job anymore. Her journey also includes numerous encounters with Social Security, medical professionals, and disability systems. In one case, she was working part-time at Walmart to pay her medical bills. Social Security decided she wasn't disabled anymore and kicked her off of her benefits. She appealed and got her benefits reinstated, but such situations create stress on people who are already dealing with barriers. Martin was not able to have children, but she dotes on her siblings, nieces, nephews, great-nieces, and great-nephews. One nephew, Alec Dink, has created a GoFundMe page on Facebook to help Martin raise the funds she needs. Donations to help Martin get the hand controls for her van may also be sent to American Legion Post 381 at 110 Kelly Street, Rome City, Indiana, 46784. The next several articles will be from the Decatur Daily Democrat, dated Tuesday, September 30th, 2025. Lieutenant Governor Beckwith staffed to host mobile office hours. Staff from the office of Lieutenant Governor Micah Beckwith will host mobile office hours in Adams County on Wednesday, October 15th, to assist Hoosiers with concerns or issues. The event will take place from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at 172 North 2nd Street, Decatur. Community members are encouraged to stop in and share feedback, ask questions, or seek assistance on state-related matters. Residents who would like more information may contact the Lieutenant Governor's office by email at asimmons@lg.in.gov or by phone at 800-457-8283. Some people tape their mouths shut at night. Doctors wish they wouldn't. An article by Kenya Hunter. Having your mouth taped shut is the stuff of nightmares, but some people are doing just that to themselves, and in an attempt to sleep better, no less. Doctors say don't do it. Some on social media say it's a hack for getting more and better sleep and to reduce snoring. The claims, which are not backed by science, are taking off on places like TikTok, sometimes pushed by people working for companies selling related products. The studies behind mouth tape are small. The benefits are modest, and the potential risks are there, said Dr. Kimberly Hutchinson, a The studies behind mouth tape are small. The benefits are modest, and the potential risks are there, said Dr. Kimberly Hutchinson, a neurologist and sleep medicine expert at Oregon Health and Science University. Some of those risks include making sleep disorders like sleep apnea worse or even causing suffocation. It is better to breathe through your nose most of the time. Mouth breathing in adults is not a major health problem, but it is better to breathe through your nose, experts say. Your nose is a natural filtering system, trapping dust and other allergens before they can get to your lungs. If you're breathing with your mouth open at night, you could wake up with a dry mouth and irritated throat, which can contribute to bad breath and oral health problems. Mouth breathing is also associated with more snoring. Don't rush to use mouth tape. But even though breathing through your nose is better than breathing through your mouth, taping your mouth shut isn't the best way to fix the issue. There's no strong evidence it helps improve sleep. A few studies have been conducted, most of which showed little or no impact, but they were so small, experts say conclusions should not be drawn from them. And meanwhile, there are the potential dangers to be avoided. Dr. David Shulman, a sleep doctor at Emory University, said there are other things to try, like prescription mouthpieces that can open up your airway, or a CPAP machine. If you're a smoker or are overweight, for example, quitting smoking and losing weight can help. Mouth breathing could be a sign of something serious, so find out. The safest approach is to figure out why exactly you are breathing with your mouth, because there could be something else going on. You may be breathing through your mouth just because you have obstructive sleep apnea, a sleep disorder where breathing repeatedly stops and starts during sleep because of a blocked airway. The disorder is linked to both open mouth breathing and snoring and is typically treated with a CPAP machine. Bad Bunny tap for Super Bowl halftime, spotlighting Latin pride in his clashes with Trump. An article by Jonathan Landrum Jr. and Adrian Gomez Lycon. The selection of Bad Bunny to headline the Super Bowl halftime show is about more than music. The move signals a cultural spotlight for Latin identity at America's most watched television event. It also raises fresh questions about how much space there will be for his trademark symbolism and social commentary, including his past criticism of President Donald Trump, given the NFL's history of keeping performances tightly managed. Here are some things to know about the selection. How the show comes together. The halftime show is a collaboration between the NFL, Roc Nation, and Apple Music. Roc Nation, Jay-Z's entertainment company, has curated performers since 2019 and returns alongside veteran producer Jesse Collins. Apple Music distributes the performance, while the NFL ultimately controls the stage, broadcast, and branding. Artists don't get a paycheck for performing. However, their payoff is global exposure. That imbalance gives the league leverage, though history shows that high-powered stars sometimes defy the league's guardrails. A stage with boundaries. The NFL has a track record of pushing back when artists get political. However, some performers don't always comply. In 2020, the league asked Jennifer Lopez to cut a segment featuring children in cages, a critique of U.S. immigration policies. She refused. In 2022, it was reported that Dr. Durr and Eminem were both advised not to kneel or reference police, but they went forward. Court rules Indiana may require biological sex on birth certificates rather than retroactive listings of gender identity. Attorney General Todd Rokita praises win for common sense. A federal district court handed a victory Monday to Indiana's policy of listing biological sex rather than gender identity on birth certificates. The court denied a request by the Americans for Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, for a preliminary injunction against the policy. This ruling is a win for truth, reason, and of course common sense, Attorney General Rokita said. Biological sex is an undeniable fact, not a feeling to be rewritten on official documents. Indiana will continue standing firm in protecting the integrity of birth certificates, ensuring they reflect reality, not ideology. Earlier this year, Governor Mike Braun issued an executive order reiterating that the term sex and gender in the Indiana Code refer to the biological characteristic of being male or female. To implement the order, the Indiana Department of Health, or IDOH, stopped changing birth certificates to list a person's gender identity instead of the person's sex. This policy change prompted a lawsuit from individuals represented by the ACLU. The federal district court declined to preliminarily enjoin Governor Braun's executive order and IDOH's policy. It rejected arguments that are refusing to let a person self-define gender on birth certificates discriminates on the basis of sex, that transgender-identifying persons are a quasi-suspect class, and that there is a fundamental right to have gender identity listed on birth certificates. Police citations. Three drivers cited. The Decatur Police Department handed out four tickets between Friday and Sunday. Hikem J. Strother, Fort Wayne, was ticketed on Friday night at 6:16 on U.S. 224 for driving while suspended, a first offense. Five tickets were written for Dylan E. Parlow, Decatur, at 1:55 a.m. Saturday on U.S. 224. The citations given to Parlow were for speeding, knowingly or intentionally operating a motor vehicle without receiving a license, operating a vehicle while intoxicated, leaving the scene of an accident, and operating a vehicle with a blood alcohol content of 0.08 or more. Zachary D. Simmons of Roanoke received a ticket for disregarding a lighted signal at 2:29 a.m. Sunday on U.S. Highway 27. Pair of arrests. The Decatur Police Department and Adams County Sheriff's Department each made an arrest over the weekend. Dylan E. Parlow, 34, of Decatur, was arrested by the Decatur Police Department for operating a motor vehicle while intoxicated, operating a motor vehicle while intoxicated, endangering, operating a vehicle without ever obtaining a license, and leaving the scene of an accident. Parlow was denied bond, and his court appearance is scheduled for 8:15 a.m. on Thursday. The Adams County Sheriff's Department served a warrant for Rogelio Hernandez Baeza, 57, of Portland. The warrant was for knowingly or intentionally operating a vehicle without ever obtaining a license. Hernandez Baeza will be held without bond until appearing in court on Thursday at 8:15 a.m. 5 wrecks. Between the Adams County Sheriff's Department, Decatur Police Department, and Bern Police Department, 5 accidents were reported on county roadways in recent days. 3 of the 5 accidents were investigated by the Sheriff's Department. At 4:50 a.m. Wednesday, Matthew D. Vaughn, Fort Wayne, was traveling south on Winchester Road at roughly 45 miles per hour when he lost control of his white Dodge Charger while navigating a curve in the road. Vaughn said the road, being wet, made it difficult to drive on. When he started sliding, Vaughn said he overcorrected the turn, causing the vehicle to go off the road and strike a utility pole. Vaughn was not injured in the crash, but his vehicle had to be towed due to the damage the front of it sustained while hitting the utility pole. An estimated $5,000 to $10,000 of damage was caused. The ACSD also probed a wreck that happened on Friday morning at 10:13 a.m. at the intersection of County Road 300 North and County Road 400 West. Kendall D. Arnold of Decatur was driving a green Wilson trailer county truck west on County Road 300 North and cut the corner while trying to turn onto County Road 400 North. He took out the stop sign after the improper turn. Arnold left the scene to go to a nearby field to farm before being requested back to the scene. No damage was done to the semi. The stop sign on the northeast corner of the intersection was destroyed. Arnold wasn't injured in the accident. The damage was estimated to be under $1,000. The third accident investigated by the ACSD happened on Friday afternoon at 4:29. Mackenzie N. Roop Decatur was heading south on County Road 500 West in a white Ford Fusion when a cat ran onto the roadway. Roop swerved to miss the cat, but her car went off the road. She ramped County Road 100 South before going into a nearby yard, taking out a small tree and a clothesline pole in the process. When the accident was probed on Friday, Roop didn't report any injuries. On Saturday, however, she told the responding officer that her left eye was swollen from the airbag and that she had a sore left ankle. Roop's vehicle was towed from the scene. The damage was estimated to be between $10,000 and $25,000. The Decatur Police Department investigated the crash at 9:30 p.m. Friday on Claremont Avenue. The owner of a white Chevrolet Cruze said that her car was parked on the street when the white Mercury Mountaineer that was being driven at the time by Dylan Parlow Decatur backed out of a driveway and into the car. The owner of the Cruze noted that Parlow was backing up rather quickly. Parlow didn't stop at the scene, claiming that he didn't realize he had backed into the Cruze. Parlow was arrested for operating while intoxicated. No injuries were reported in the accident. $1,000 to $2,500 was the estimated range of damage stemming from the collision. The accident examined by the Bern Police Department took place at 2:24 p.m. Sunday at a gas station on North U.S. Highway 27. Donald Beck of Bern was facing west at the northernmost gas pump. That's when his car began rolling backward. The car only stopped when it collided with the vehicle that was being driven by Sean Auker of Bern. Neither vehicle was occupied at the time of the accident. Damage was done to the back of Auker's car, while Beck didn't spot any damage to his vehicle. Nobody was hurt in the wreck. The damage was estimated to be between $2,500 and $5,000. Trump's trade battle with China puts U.S. soybean farmers in peril. An article by Dee Dee Tang and Josh Funk, Associated Press, Magnolia, Kentucky. The leafy soybean plants reach Caleb Ragland's thighs and are ripe for harvest. But the Kentucky farmer is deeply worried. He doesn't know where he and others like him will sell their crop because China has stopped buying. Beijing, which traditionally has snapped up at least a quarter of all soybeans grown in the U.S., is in effect boycotting them in retaliation for the high tariffs President Donald Trump has imposed on Chinese goods, and to strengthen its hand in negotiations over a new overall trade deal. It has left American soybean farmers fretting over not only this year's crop, but the long-term viability of their businesses, built in part on China's once insatiable appetite for U.S. beans. "This is a five-alarm fire for our industry," said Raglan, who leads the American Soybean Association trade group. "The situation might even be enough to test farmers' loyalty to Trump, although he still enjoys strong support throughout rural America. If no deal is reached soon, they hope the government will come through with aid, as it did during Trump's first term, but they see that only as a temporary solution." Trump said Thursday he is considering an aid package. U.S. and Chinese officials have held four rounds of trade talks between May and September, with another likely in the coming weeks. No progress on soybeans has been reported. "Getting closer to harvest, I'm honestly getting worried that the time is running out," said Jim Sutter, CEO of the U.S. Soybean Export Council. Political pressure is growing. After Trump imposed tariffs on Chinese goods, China responded with tariffs of its own, which now total up to 34% on U.S. soybeans. That makes soybeans from other countries cheaper. China's retaliatory tariffs also hit U.S. growers of sorghum, corn, and cotton, and even geoduck divers have been affected. But soybeans stand out because of the crop's outsized importance to U.S. agricultural exports. Soybeans are the top U.S. food export, accounting for about 14% of all farm goods sent overseas. And China has been by far the largest foreign buyer. Last year, the U.S. exported nearly $24.5 billion worth of soybeans, and China accounted for more than $12.5 billion. That compared with $2.45 billion by the European Union, the second largest buyer. This year, China hasn't bought beans since May. With U.S. farmers hurting, the Trump administration is under growing pressure to reach a deal with China. As talks drag on, Trump appears ready to help. "We're going to take some of the tariff money, relatively small amount, but a lot for the farmers. And we're going to help the farmers out a little bit during this transition period," Trump said. The only way most farmers survived Trump's trade war in his first term was with tens of billions of dollars in government payments. But that's not what most farmers want. What farmers expect from Trump? "The American farmer, especially myself included, we don't want aid payments," said Brian Warpup, 52, a fourth-generation farmer from Warren, Indiana. "We want to work. We work the land, we harvest the land, and crop off the land. And the worst thing that we could ever want is a handout." Farmers are looking to Trump for a long-term solution. "Overwhelmingly, farmers have been in President Trump's corner," said Raglan, the president of the Soybean Association. "And I think the message that our soybean farmers as a whole want to deliver is, President Trump, we've had your back. We need you to have ours now." He said farmers appreciate the willingness to provide some short-term relief, but what they ultimately need are strong, reliable markets. "Our priority remains seeing the United States secure lasting trade agreements, particularly with China, that allow farmers to sell their crops and build a sustainable future with long-term customers," he said. Raglan, 39, hopes his three sons will become the 10th generation to till his 4,500 acres in Magnolia, Kentucky. "Unless something changes soon, he worries that thousands of farmers may not survive." Coming into this year, many farmers were just hoping to break even because crop prices were weak, while their costs had only increased. Trump's tariffs, which helped make their crops uncompetitive around the world, drove prices down further. And tariffs on steel and fertilizers sent costs up even more. Darren Johnson, president of the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association, said he still has faith in the Trump administration to reach a good deal with China. "I think where the patience is probably wearing thin is the time," said Johnson, a fourth-generation farmer. "I don't think anybody thought that we were going to take this much time because we were told 90 deals in 90 days. China's negotiating strategy. The U.S. soybean industry grew in response to Chinese demand starting back in the 1990s, when China began its rapid economic rise and turned to foreign producers to help feed its people. Protein-rich soybeans are an essential part of the diet. While China relies on domestic crops for steamed beans and tofu, it needs far more soybeans for oil extraction and animal feed. In 2024, China produced 20 million metric tons of soybeans while importing more than 105 million metric tons. American farmers have come to count on China as their biggest customer, and this has given the Chinese a point of leverage, Sutter said. By holding off on buying U.S. soybeans, China is seen as trying to leverage that purchasing power in the trade talks. I think that's the strategy, said Sutter of the U.S. Soybean Export Council. I think that's why China is targeting soybeans and other agricultural products, because they know that farmers have a strong lobby and farmers are important to the U.S. government. Liu Pengguo, spokesperson for the Chinese embassy in Washington, didn't answer specific questions on soybean purchases, but urged the U.S. to work with Beijing. The essence of China-U.S. economic and trade cooperation is mutual benefit and win-win, Liu said. China turned to Brazil when Trump launched his first trade war in 2018. Last year, Brazilian beans accounted for more than 70% of China's imports, while the U.S. share was down to 21%. World Bank data shows Argentina and other South American countries are also getting and selling more to China, which has diversified to boost food security. What American farmers are doing in response? U.S. farmers also are broadening their customer base, said Sutter, who recently traveled to Japan and Indonesia in search of new markets. Taiwan pledged to purchase $10 billion worth of soybeans, corn, wheat, and beef in the next 4 years. There's strong diversification efforts underway, Sutter said, but China is so big, it's hard to replace them overnight. Farmers are working to boost consumption at home, too. Growth in biodiesel production has taken in some of the soybeans that were once exported. Others are crushed to produce soybean oil and soybean meal. The United Soybean Board is investing in research into the benefits of using soybeans to feed dairy cows and hogs. But Iowa farmer Rob Ewald, a director with the Soybean Board, knows that such domestic uses are growing gradually. We cannot replace a China in one shot, Ewald said. It's not going to happen. We need to be realistic in that. In sports news, Braves and Jets to meet in tennis sectional semis, Starfires draw Bluffton. An article by Matthew Klinkenberger. The pairings for this week's IHSAA Boys Tennis Sectionals were revealed at 6 p.m. Sunday in a broadcast that aired from Indianapolis. With tennis programs not being divided into classes on the basis of enrollment, the three Adams County teams came in knowing they would all be grouped into the Norwell sectional. On Sunday, however, the trio learned who they would face first. Sectional 50 begins Tuesday with South Adams taking on Bluffton. The Tigers won the sectional a season ago. South Adams and Bluffton faced off in Bern on September 18th, with the Tigers recording a 4-1 win on that occasion. The winner between the Starfires and Tigers will advance to the sectional semifinals Wednesday to face Norwell. Adams Central and Belmont make up the other semifinal. When the two clubs met in Decatur on September 2nd, Adams Central won 4 of the 5 matches. Whichever sides advance past the semifinals will meet in the sectional championship on Thursday. Saturday has been designated as the makeup date, should rain impact the schedule. The champion of Sectional 50 will head to Bluffton on October 7th to take on the winner of Sectional 52 in the regional semifinals. Sectional 52, which will be played at Peru, features Rochester Community, Bakaniqua, Manchester, and Wabash, along with the sectional host. The sectional champions at Homestead and Madison Grant will battle for the other ticket to the regional final. Emergence from the Bluffton regional will result in a trip to Homestead to take on the winner of the Noblesville bracket for the right to play at state finals at Indianapolis North Central High School on October 17th and 18th. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Pat Weiss with Area News. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Ella County Public Library.